podcast that you're about to hear comes from a program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. These sessions have been facilitated by Christian Teusner from the Emu Tree in partnership with the Wakery RSL sub-branch. To explore further podcasts, visit thewaywewere.podbean.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening. This podcast is part one for Peter Scott, with further podcasts to follow shortly. Today I'm talking to Colonel Peter Scott. Thank you, Peter, for having me come to your home today to talk with you. Can I start things off and just ask you to clarify your full name and your date of birth, please?
Francis Peter Scott, 19th of the 1st, 1929.
Can you tell me, first of all, where were you born and a little bit about your parents?
Right, I was born in Elstonwick, Victoria, and I think my parents at that stage, I'm not quite sure where they were living, but my first memory of where we lived was in Coburg, near the penitentiary, and my father at that time was working in the docks as a clerk for the Adelaide Shipping Company. And then we moved to a house. When his parents died, they were living in Sydney, in St Kilda. And when his parents died, we moved, I think it must have been Sandringham. And from Sandringham, my father used to work still in the docks. And my mother was a homekeeper. And as far as I'm concerned, she never went to work after her early period in the theatre with her sister. And then I can remember going to, I think, Sandringham State School. And then the war came and my father enlisted in World War II and served in Egypt and Thursday Island, and he was commissioned, and then he worked in Victoria Barracks, Melbourne.
Could you tell me your parents' names?
Francis Keith and Jean Agnes. And then we were living in Sandringham whilst he was away during the war, and I had a sister who was 18 months older than me, and she went to Shilford Girls Grammar School, I think, and I went to Brighton Technical School, which meant a train journey every day to and from the school, which was okay because the train was line ended at Sandringham, so it was quite convenient and probably 5 minutes from where I lived to the train. So I did quite well at Brighton Technical School. I became the head prefect and also a senior under officer in the cadet corps. When my father came back from the war and I wanted to go to Duntroon, he said, "Oh, well, you'll have a better chance if you go to my old school," which was Caulfield Grammar School. So in 1945, I went to Caulfield Grammar School and I became a cadet lieutenant in the cadets. And I put my application in to go to Duntroon and it was accepted. So I went into Duntroon in 1946 for a three-year course, which was the last of the three-year courses at Duntroon. And I graduated from Duntroon in December 1948.
Any particular memories of that period that stand out?
I suppose the main things that we did in Sandringham was, A, we were very close to the beach, so we did a lot of swimming and fishing and stuff. And I can remember that on a Saturday afternoon, we always went to the Saturday afternoon pictures, and there was always a trailer on up along Cassidy or one of those old serials. I don't remember too much about other things that we did, because apart from the fact that I didn't have a car, so my father's aunt was out in Glen Iris and his sister was down in Beaumaris. So we used to visit them alternatively on the weekends, and it was a very long visit to go, particularly to Beaumaris, because it was all public transport. I really enjoyed the cadet corps. That was I was in that for about 4 years, so I did very well in that. And that and the war probably convinced me or turned me towards going into the army as a career, which I did so I spent 3 years in Duntroon, 1946 to 1948. I became a Lance Corporal, I think. Nothing very significant, but they were good years. I enjoyed them. I survived and graduated as a lieutenant in December 1948. And I graduated into the infantry corps, which was the one that I had my second preference. But anyway, I've always been very pleased that I did get it. And from there...
And that was 1948
as well? That was December 1948, yes. And from there, there were 13 of us were graduated into infantry, and we were posted to... the School of Tactics and Administration for a 12-week revision course, I suppose, but they couldn't do anything with us because we knew everything. And then we went to Japan in March 1949. We flew by, it was a RAF, Lancastrian, converted Lancastrian. And I think it was being run at that stage by Qantas, I'm not quite sure. But we had stops in Darwin, Manila, and then Iwakuni, which was the RAF base in Japan. And for the next 18 months, I was a platoon commander in the 3rd Battalion, the Royal Australian Regiment, who were part of the British Commonwealth Occupation Force, and we were training as a platoon and also providing guards in Tokyo. And in Tokyo, the companies were up there on rotation, and I went up there fairly quickly in B Company as a platoon commander in 4 Platoon. And we had to do guards on the Imperial Palace, the British High Commission, Canadian High Commission, and the GOC of Bykov, General Officer Commanding Bykov in Tokyo. So we had 24 hours on guard duty, 24 hours leave, and 24 hours make and mend. So it was sort of training, I suppose. And we did that for about 6 weeks, and then we rotated back to Hero, which is where the battalion base was, and we would train up in a place called Haramura, H-A-R-A-M-U-R-A, and we did sort of field firing and tactics and things like that there. Now, during 1949, that was, and then 1950, the instructions were that we were to close down and come back to Australia by the end of 1950, I think it was. But in the intervening period, on the 25th of June, the North Koreans invaded South Korea, and the Australian government was asked to provide assistance to the Americans. To General MacArthur was the commander of the occupation force, and then he became the commander of the or United Nations forces mm-hmm. that went to Korea. And Australia was asked to commit, and the first elements were the 77 Squadron, which was a fighter squadron in Iwakuni. And then the ships of the Navy were also put on standby. And then finally, 3RAR was put on standby to go to Korea.
How did you feel at this time, Peter? How did you...
Thrilled a bit. What war?
At this point, you were 21 years of age?
I had my 21st birthday in Japan, yes, yes. In what would it have been? It would have been January 50. Yeah, January 50. And the Pioneer Platoon used to make brass keys to give you the as a symbol of being 21. And we had lots of functions in the mess and lots of training. And I played rugby in the battalion team. And not sure. Oh, we used to play a bit of golf up in a place called Kawana, which was the British Commonwealth Occupation Force leave centre. And it was, if you go up there on a, not a regular basis, but on leave and play golf and drink, of course. Pretty well behaved most of the time. One interesting point was that before I went to Japan, I was at a party in Melbourne and I met this girl and she was going to Japan. So we decided that we would meet next year on New Year's Eve in the main street of Tokyo. Well, that fell flat because the main street of Tokyo is miles and miles long. And, of course, we never met, but it was a nice sort of arrangement, I guess. It was a marvellous occupation because every officer had a house girl as a that looked after you, your room and your clothes and everything concerned with that. You got up in the morning and she was there with a cup of tea, and she, while you had a shower, she'd lay out your trousers and your uniform for the day. And you come back after the day's work and change into sports gear. And then by the time you had your shower, your next uniform would be laid out for you to go to the dinner, mess dinner, which we dressed every night. And of interest was that the 2IC at this time was Major I.B. Bruce Ferguson, who was a World War II soldier, officer, and he eventually became the CO of 3RAR after Lieutenant Colonel Green had been killed. He was killed lying in his bed and a shell burst above his tent, and he was wounded seriously and died the next day. So then there was a temporary CO, and then Ferguson came in. And now, at that particular point in after the we were alerted for war, which was June 1950.
Excited, yeah.
Excited, we were going to war. I was commanding a platoon, so it was very exciting and very something that we had been trained for. So we were on guard duty in Tokyo at the time. So we had to come back from there and start training. And unfortunately, I was involved with a training accident, and I didn't go to Korea immediately with the battalion. I had taken my platoon out for a live grenade throwing exercise. And there was one blind at the end of it. So I decided that I would go and blow this grenade up by putting another grenade beside it. And so when I did that, I went back about 3 or 4 metres behind a little mound and I thought that would be enough for me to be protected. And the grenade that I put down blew up, and I stood up, and the blind went off, and the grenade hit me in the back, and I was on a plane back to Australia the next day, which was very demoralising for having been training with my platoon, and the battalion went to Korea on, I think it was about the 28th, 29th of September. They went to Korea, and they were there for the next 3 years. So what happened then was that I was in hospital in Sydney for about 3 months. My parents were in Melbourne, so they didn't come up, but they had plenty of, my mother had plenty of relatives who were sent to visit me in Concord Military Hospital. And finally I went home to Melbourne, and I was reposted to the 2nd Battalion, which was based in Puckapunyal. So I spent 6 months virtually with 2RAR in Puckapunyal as a, can't quite remember really what I did, but I guess I was a platoon commander. And I used to play rugby for the Army rugby team in Melbourne. And then finally, after frequent requests, I was reposted to 3RAR in Korea in July 1951. And I was given the platoon, what was it, number 3 platoon I was given as the OC. My company commander at that stage was a Captain Jimmy Shelton, who was a senior classmate in Duntroon, so I knew him. And the 2IC was the same class at Duntroon. He was senior class, and his name was Alec Alec Priest. Mm. So I spent the next...
So you were reposted to 3RA then. Whereabouts was that?
They were in Korea, on a place called the Lozenge Feature, overlooking the Imjin River, I-M-J-I-M River, which was quite an obstacle. And the Chinese were over the other side of the river, and we were on the southern side, which incidentally really is approximately the ceasefire line. Yep. Yeah, ceasefire line. Now, I did patrolling over the river into enemy territory on frequent occasions, not as a platoon, but the company did that. And we never encountered anybody, but we had problems crossing the river because if it rained, the river swelled to such a degree that it became a huge obstacle. And I can remember quite clearly on one occasion digging our slit trenches on the other side and standing to in a trench full of water. And then we had to evacuate the next day and go back to our permanent position on the south side of the river. And I was the platoon commander there for July, August, September. Then the CO made me the intelligence officer, which was very interesting because that is a position that you supervise the intelligence section in the collation and the of information, the assembly of that information, the distribution of that information to the companies and to brigade headquarters, of which we were part of the 28th Brigade, 28th British Commonwealth Brigade. So it was a very important job to and to keep the CO informed of all the enemy activities and give his maps and keep him up to date with as much as I could. And he eventually became his sort of staff officer. And not long after I was made the intelligence officer, division, which was the 1st Commonwealth Division, was ordered to make an advance to capture Hill 355 and Hill 317. And the brigade, 28th Brigade, was given that particular task as well. And the of the brigade, King's Own Scottish Borderers were given the task of capturing 355 and 3RAR to capture Hill 317. And this commenced on the 2nd of October. So it was just a matter of days after I became the IO. So the CO at this time was Lieutenant Colonel Frank Hassett, who became Chief of the Defence Force eventually, a marvellous inspirational leader. And he produced this plan to encircle 317 from the right flank, eastern flank, I suppose. Anyway, that was his plan. And it was over the period 2nd to the 5th of October, with companies leapfrogging. And on the 3rd of October, the battalion was asked to help the British capture 355. So that was a side issue. So we actually shared the capture of 355 with the KOSBs, King's Own Scottish Borderers. Then we advanced, and the battalion, it's a bit hard to describe each part of it, but A Company was in the valley going towards as a diversion, and the other companies were on the ridgeline heading towards 317. On the 6th of October, C Company was ordered to capture 317, which they did. The conditions were very, very arduous because it was a very steep slope, strewn with rocks and debris and hills and trees that had all been blown up by the artillery that we had been putting on the point. And the next day, the CO decided to go up to 317 and sit on 317, which with myself and the artillery battery commander, who was my Captain Arthur Roxburgh at that stage, a New Zealander. And from there, he wanted to direct the advance to a feature called the Henge, which was about, I don't know, about 1,000 metres away, I suppose. And B Company was given that job. Then all hell broke loose because the Chinese were pushed off it. They were pushed off 317 and then a place called Sierra, which was next to 317. And then they were pushed off the Henge. And they didn't like that, so it was like stirring up a hive of hornets. So that happened on the night of the 7th, when B Company was... the CO and I and the B battery commander were up on 317 directing the attack onto the Henge. Then we went back to battalion headquarters, which was back down in the valley. But that night, 7th of October, was a hell of a night because B Company repulsed 3 regimental attacks. They suffered a lot of casualties, but they didn't give in. And there was a lot of decorations given for the bravery and heroism on that occasion. Well, through the whole battle, I suppose. Then we handed over that area to the Cosbys, KOSBs, I think. Yeah, KOSBs. And we withdrew to a place of 3,000 or 4,000 metres to the east, where we remained for about another 3 weeks, and somewhere on about the 4th of November, the Chinese attacked the Hinge and 317 and eventually recaptured it, which we were very upset about because we'd captured it, and then the Cosbys had to give up. Well, I suppose it was probably the weight of numbers that actually persuaded them to retire. So that was the major battle of the war, as far as I was concerned. There had been an earlier one, which was called the Battle of Cap Yong, which I think a lot of historians sort of are aware of, because the battalion on that occasion...
Rocky spoke about that one.
Yeah, he was there in A Company. And that was the a very hasty defensive position that they occupied. And they were awarded the United States Presidential Citation for their success in stemming the Chinese advance to Seoul.
Mm.
So that was the first major battle. There were other battles, of course, and you could say they were all major. But then Mariang Sang was the one that I was in, and the one that... I'm trying to think of a name of the...
Mariang Sang that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
That was the name of the battle you've just described.
Yes, that's what we call it, the Battle of Mariang Sang, which was 317. I'm trying to think of the name of the official historian, O'Neill. It's O'Neill. And he, I'll think of his name in a minute, but he was the one that thought and described it in the official history as the most significant battle of the Korean War. Now, the rest of the time the battalion was involved with patrolling and moving into reserve and then back into the line again. And eventually I asked the CO, can I go back to a platoon? I thought I'd done my dashes in a pretty quiet sort of area. So he appointed me to the OC of the anti-tank platoon, which was equipped with 17-pounder anti-tank guns. And so I got permission to bring one up to the forward defence position. And I used to harass the Chinese with this 17-pounder gun, which they didn't like, and all the reaction went to the rest of the battalion. They didn't affect me. And after...
What sort of range would they have?
Oh, about 3,000 or 4,000 metres, and pinpoint accuracy. That is on a horizontal. So I did my 365 days, and I was posted to the School of Infantry in Seymour, Victoria, along with a lot of the other officers from 3RAR went there as well, including the CO. So there were about, and so we had another party. Very, 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 very close comradeship.
If you or someone you know would like to be captured in a podcast, contact Christian Teusner via this email address, theemutree@gmail.com. treee@gmail.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening.